Speer, though, has many devotees. The Speer carriers, the keepers of the toxic flame. Chief among them is one Leon Krier, a man who genuinely believes that Speer is the greatest architect of the 20th century. This is a piffling opinion and would be of absolutely no moment were it not for the fact that Krier is one of the chief architectural advisors to the Prince of Wales.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Imran Khan in Pakistan takes an interview with opposition leader off the air in mid-sentence and closes down three private TV stations. What's he up to? And Jeffrey Epstein, friend of Prince Andrew, is arrested for child trafficking in the US. Meanwhile, the British ambassador to the United States, Sir Kim Darroch, resigns. Boris Johnson is blamed, but should the real story be about how such memos find themselves on the front page of a national newspaper and what the motivation for that might be? Turkey takes its first shipment of S-400 anti-aircraft missiles from Russia. The Americans reply by threatening to cancel sales to their NATO ally of the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter. At £70 million a pop, and with the terrible record for unreliability, can we cancel ours too, please? And the Venezuelan ambassador to London, speaking in Bristol last Friday evening, we carried her speech and those of the Cuban and Nicaraguan ambassadors live, but we got cut off. We hear the end of her speech about the Monroe Doctrine and the concept of South America as North America's backyard. Sister show Dialects here on BCFM on Tuesday at noon this week. Alan Brown, who you just heard there actually, takes us through the new EU government menagerie and asks where power lies if we get to decide anything important in Brussels. How accountable are these people? Also, Alex Craner, author of Grand Deception, a book about Bill Browder and the Magnitsky Act, which aims to stop Russia getting any of their assets stolen back in the 1990s back again. Alex talks, about the Russian oligarchs. Who were they and what are they up to now? You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday or download the show right now from dialectradio.co.uk. But Martin, I think we should start by picking up where we left off last week, really, in Latin America, the backyard. What is this Monroe Doctrine that the Venezuelan ambassador Rocío del Valle Manerio González was talking about when we had to cut
her
off?
Monroe Doctrine, off the top of my head, it was in the 1820s, I think. Monroe was the president of the United States in those days. And the Monroe Doctrine was that no outside powers were to interfere in Latin America, and by that they meant the British, the Spanish, anybody really, this was to be an exclusive zone in which they, as the dominant power, would deal with South America as partners, if you like, but at the same time they were definitely not going to allow anybody else into that region they regarded it as their backyard, quite literally. And of course, you know, if you live in Mexico or Nicaragua, you're not that far from America, and they do very much treat them as their backyard.
Back in June, Al Jazeera reported this. I put a link up to this on our show page. page at thisweek.org.uk. Trump revives the Munro Doctrine as a warning to China and Russia. So I think it sounds like you're absolutely right. Latin American countries long demonised the doctrine, which historically gave Washington a blank check to intervene, they say. In November 2013, former US Secretary of State John Kerry created a social media frenzy with a speech delivered at the Organisation of American States, the world's oldest regional forum. The era of the Monroe Doctrine is over, he announced. Kerry was, of course, referring to the nearly 200-year-old symbol of US gunboat diplomacy in Central and South America and the Caribbean. Named after President James Monroe in 1823, the doctrine basically states America is for the Americans, and the United States has the right to intervene in any nation south of its borders to ensure that other countries do not exert their influence there.
Well, that's a pretty good summary of what I just said. I mean, that's the truth. That's what it's about.
But Trump has now reversed this. The idea is, of course, that Russia and China, Russia and Venezuela, particularly China elsewhere, may be saying, well, look, you know, we can invest in your countries too. The Americans are saying, no, you can't.
Well, what Lavrov said to him when they brought this Monroe Doctrine stuff up and said, what the hell are you doing in Ukraine then? Perhaps you'd just better go back to Latin America. Of course, in Latin America itself...
But Europe doesn't have a Monroe Doctrine, does it? The Americans can intervene in the Middle East and Europe.
Really, yes.
In the South China Sea or wherever they want to, Martin.
Yeah, and the Monroe Doctrine was from the 1820s onwards, and basically they said we can intervene in Latin America. But of course, as we well know, Vietnamese peasants will tell you, they don't just intervene in Latin America. They just make sure that's, you know, it's very hard for progressive forces to get anywhere in Latin America because the Americans are very close and very powerful.
Anyway, let's go back now to this time last week with the Venezuelan ambassador speaking at Tony Benn House here in Bristol. We were carrying live Rocío del Valle Manero González talking about this Monroe Doctrine. And we'll run to the end of her speech, the final speech of the three, the Nicaraguan, the Cuban and the Venezuelan ambassadors.
At this moment, we have no access to the financial system. We cannot negotiate in dollars. Sometimes we can do it also in euros. They are blockading the imports of medicines. They are paralyzing our oil industry. They are freezing our assets. It's incredible what they are doing to Venezuela. Why are they doing this? Why? Well, because back in 1902, President Monroe said that America is for Americans and that you have a back chart. Everybody wants a back chart at this moment. China has his back chart. Everybody has a back chart. But this back chart happened to say, listen, let us change things back in the 80s. It's developed in the 90s and in the first decade of the 21st century, you have there Cuba, that was the leader, Venezuela, Nicaragua, Ecuador, and all Latin American turmoil. They have to do something. It is not Trump. It's just Trump is, you know, like an elephant in a... He's a very heavy person, no? In his way. Yes. But it's the same thing. Obama is more another kind of person. That's it. It's the image, but it's the same thing. They need the backyard. They need our resources. They need to break the way we started to function. We started to put in place a very rare kind of cooperation. A cooperation among us. In health. We went out and say, Cuba went out and say, okay, how many blinds there are in Panama? Let me do the mission miracle and keep them their eyes. That's not good. That is not good. And Venezuela say, okay, let us do financial cooperation. Let us go to the Antillas. Let us go to the Caribbean. Let us go to our friends and give them money. For what? Well, to cooperate, for invest, for producing. And we started to create another model, a model among friends of equality, nothing that has to do with the subordination that they are used to. At least in the relations between United States and Latin America, that has been the case for years and years and years. So they have to break Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua, because that's the only way to control everything. If Venezuela goes down at this moment, everything is going down. We are not going to permit that. We are not going to allow that. And we need you. We need you. Why? Because, you know, a word is more important than 1,000 rifles. A word is very important. And if you continue, if you read and communicate among all of you, there is a constituency, I don't know if that's the name or whatever, in London, that about a week ago, they came out and say to their MPs, why you don't talk in the parliament and ask the government about what is really happening in Venezuela, in Nicaragua? Why don't you do that? I contacted them. I'm going to have a meeting with them on Monday. They are asking their MPs. So that's what we need. We need to do not take what I tell you as a truth. Just read, listen. Even with this blockade, we are giving 75% of the money we have to our social programs. We are working hard in Nicaragua and Cuba, and we will prevail because they are not going to take us down. With the opinion and the goodwill of all of you here and in Europe and in everywhere, I'm sure of that. And thank you. Thank you for listening.
Okay, well, that was Rocio del Valle Manerio González, Venezuelan ambassador, speaking the tail end of her speech last week. Martin, what's the prospects for, do you think, these left-wing countries over in Venezuela to resist pressure from a much more powerful United States to control that continent, part of the continent?
The situation is pretty dire. But the only positive thing I could say is that there was a definite attempt to remove the Maduro government, including two assassination attempts on Maduro, but it didn't take off. It just didn't work. They presumed that the army could be bullied or bribed to change sides, and they just miscalculated there completely. The Venezuelan army has been completely overhauled during the Chavista era, and it's no longer stuffed with crusty old generals who are friendly with the United States. It's got, you know, new, younger, more militant people in charge, and the army is the core of what's kept, because in the rest of Latin America, the armies, by and large, Bolsonaro's a former army captain during the military dictatorship in Brazil. He actually openly justifies the military dictatorship and said, we tortured too much and killed too little. Those are his exact words. We should have killed more people. And that's the problem you've got in all of Latin America, is that the military are basically all trained in the United States, but they used to be trained at the School of the Americas in Georgia. They were trained in torture techniques and all the rest of it. But the Venezuelan army was revolutionized by Chavez, especially after the attempted coup in 2003.
To what extent do you think that blew back in the Americans' face, that? Because it might just be that simply that they were doing it to wind everybody up. I mean, the Americans were saying, oh, we could have a successful coup in Venezuela just to...
Well, I mean, that's what they admitted.
Some
pranksters got through to Elliot Abrahams, and he basically said, well, we're not going to be able to overthrow them, but we just want to keep them on the back foot and frighten the hell out of them. But also, they basically didn't get what they wanted, and they are, you know, that's what I was going to say. A lot of the Venezuelan military elite opened into negotiations, supposedly individually, with the CIA, saying that they would all support a coup. And then on the morning when they were all supposed to carry out the coup, they all switched their phones off. Because they just let them talk. And the U.S. basically threatened the senior military in Venezuela that if they didn't give in, they were all going to be, you know, hounded down and assassinated or possibly put in prison, etc., etc. But if they did, then they would all get a big payoff and they'd all get patted on the back and they'd all keep their jobs. So they all went along with it.
Isn't this just American?
And then just dropped them in.
American hubris? They think their power is far more than
that
actually
right.
is.
The idea that they could browbeat the Venezuelan military was just wrong.
They are believing their own propaganda too.
Well, that's right. But a bit like the Nazis, the propaganda loop includes the people who are making the propaganda, and that's why they make mistakes, because they're not objective in assessing what their possibilities and prospects actually are.
Love Bristol. Love BCFM 93.2.
So let's go back now to this week, and I suppose you could almost look upon it as a war with Iran, but with a home front about anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. I mean, there seems to be this whole Middle East issue as it goes into the, you know, blow by blow, week after week, more and more accusations. This week it's Tom Watson, your deputy leader, who's been saying that Jeremy Corbyn simply not got to grips with it and that this is a very real issue within your party.
Shall I answer that? There is clearly a link between the Israeli government's efforts to try and suborn the Labour Party and the war with Iran that the neoconservatives in America want. And of course they see Jeremy Corbyn and the pro-Palestinian factions within the Labour Party as a problem, which is why you only take flak when you take loads of flak, you know you're over the target. They are trying to push us into a war with Iran, and this is all part of it.
But what about this concept of this being actually the home front? Business of anti-Semitism going on the TV here in the UK, everyone's supposedly getting upset about
it. We're being softened up. But of course, if we do go, there is no real popular support in this country for a war with Iran. We're obsessing about Brexit. We don't care about Iran.
Is there a popular concern about anti-Semitism?
No, not really. I would suggest that there's a very vocal minority of people who are very well organised and actually have lots of resources, which are coming from a foreign power. What point don't people understand about the factual matter that the Mossad officer at the Israeli embassy said we've got £1 million to spend to get the Labour Party to do what we want?
Are you saying that Tom Watson is working for the Israeli government?
No, what happens is that everybody gets bamboozled by... There are people who are working directly for the Israeli government. The Jewish Labour movement takes money from the Israeli government. I don't think I can be sued for saying that, because they would probably say, yes, we do. We go there all the time and they pay for the jollies. I think there's a political fight to be had about the pro-Israeli and pro-Palestinian factions within the Labour Party, and that's what this is really about. Anti-Semitism, they're trying to define anti-Semitism as people who are against the existence of the State of Israel.
Okay, well, meanwhile, but over in
that's
the,
not anti-Semitism, that's politics.
Meanwhile, the other side of the war, over in the Persian Gulf, House has rebuked Trump on Yemen. They also, we've had this United States trying to get a coalition together of battleships. The British have just announced they're sending another one, not battleship. I imagine it's a destroyer, a frigate or something, today to the Persian Gulf to escort British tankers backwards and forwards. But the idea is a sort of NATO coalition of some sort to escort tankers through the Straits of Hormuz.
That's because the US is completely isolated, apart from its Saudi and Israeli allies, on this whole thing of ripping up this Iran nuclear deal. Now, the British, but presumably I would suggest what I smell here is that elements within the deep state in Britain agreed to use the Royal Marines to attack this Iranian tanker, which the Iranians say wasn't even going to Syria, so that then the British would be in the crosshairs, then something would happen. Incidentally, I've been reading this week that it wasn't the British government who said there'd been an incident in the Gulf. The Americans briefed that the British had had a run-in with the Iranians. The Iranians, interestingly, are saying, no, there wasn't, we didn't have a run-in with you. So who to believe? You know, I mean, the game is clear. We're being nudged towards confrontation with Iran.
What they kept saying was words like was attempting to interfere with the passage of a British tanker. Well, that might mean that they were just somewhere quite near them. Iran guards, you're quite right, Martin, on antiwar.com. It says Iran guards have denied any attempts to capture a British tanker.
Yeah, so in other words, they're saying we didn't. And you're saying, you know, in other words, there's a game of smoke and mirrors going on. Can I just point out that these tankers are all in Iranian waters? It's their territorial waters, just as the tanker that was stopped at Gibraltar was in British territorial waters. Not that the Spanish agree that they should be British territorial waters.
It wasn't stopped in British territorial waters. Oh. It was stopped in international disputed Moroccan waters, actually.
Oh, right. Well, in actual fact, the British tanker...
Then moved into British territorial waters.
The British tanker was confronted inside Iranian territorial waters. You would have thought that the Iranians had an absolute right to come to any tanker inside their own territorial waters and say, right... whatever.
Were they trying to board it, or were they just chugging alongside?
The Iranians just said we didn't do anything.
And what about the idea of a whole bunch of Iranian warships suddenly popping up in the channel and escorting ferries backwards and forwards to France?
Well, that hasn't happened, has it, Tony? You're just making that up.
No, of course, but I'm saying that this is effectively what it's like for Iranians.
Well, indeed. I mean, the fact of the matter is you have to ask us, where is the Gulf, the Persian Gulf? Why is it called the Persian Gulf? It's because Persia is what is now called Iran, and it's their Gulf. Can you imagine if the Iranians, the Chinese or the Russians, were playing games like that in the English Channel? Boris Johnson, his toupee would be exploding, you know.
What about this week's resignation of the British ambassador, Sir Kim Darroch, to the US, apparently because of these leaked cables? Now, absolutely amazing that such cables should suddenly find themselves on the front pages of a newspaper.
Well, that's the first thing that crossed my mind. When you get a leak like that, somebody has leaked it to purpose. And the British government at the moment are saying it wasn't hacked because there was the Russians.
I mean, Theresa May might leak it. She's got nothing to lose at the moment.
No, I mean, that's interesting, isn't it? I don't know who leaked it, and there's going to be an investigation, apparently, and if they find who leaked it, they're going to possibly do prison time.
They won't find anything. I can almost
guarantee that. Well, it's very difficult to trace these things, isn't it?
And I would suggest that we're looking at an administration now on its way out that's thinking, well, what can we do on our way out? And one of the things they can do, of course, is to, make trouble, I suppose, between the US and Britain. This surely helps the... spiking the guns of the Brexiteers who are trying to build relations with the US. Suddenly we find Trump has basically kicked this guy out, hasn't he?
Yeah, well, I mean, the fact it's hardly a surprise that an urbane British ambassador in private will be saying, well, my private briefing to you is they are inept, incompetent. He wasn't being political, he's just saying that they're a shambles.
What would the US ambassador be saying about Theresa May right now?
Well, the US ambassadors, you've got to realise, are political appointees. British ambassadors are career civil servants. There's a big difference. I don't know whether Trump knows the difference, but ambassadors from the US are basically political appointees. The US ambassador to Germany is a super pro-Trump supporter who chooses every opportunity to tell the Germans off because they're not doing the things Trump wants. So British ambassadors don't do
that. What's your assessment? Why did this end up in the newspapers, all these secret cables? It's almost like WikiLeaks or something.
Well, I think what's going on here is probably some fairly low-level Foreign Office person has said, well, look, look, this is you know, the Trump administration.
Politically explosive stuff.
This is explosive stuff, and I can't resist just dropping this out there, because it's bound to cause ructions. And that's probably, you're probably right.
You know,
it probably is people inside the British structure who are unhappy with the relationship developing between Trump and Johnson, and they are trying to make it life difficult for him. But of course, this ambassador becomes collateral damage.
Official Secrets Act, well, we're not going to bother with that.
Well, there was a big debate in Parliament I was reading about, and loads of people were saying that they're all very unhappy about it, and whoever's leaked it is going to be punished, if they can find him.
But I bet they won't, and they probably have covered their tracks.
Well, in any case, the politics of it are quite clear. Trump's attitude towards Britain is that it is basically, you do as I say, or I'm going to get really,
This whole thing of having incompetent governments. I mean, I don't think Britain's government could be considered any less competent or more competent than Trump's. Isn't there some sort of angle to this where incompetence in elected governments actually suits some people quite well?
Yeah.
It suits the banks. It suits the big corporations, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean,
and it suits the warmongers too.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I think the warmongers maybe not so much in this particular case, because Trump is about to ask Boris Johnson to go to war with Iran for him. And this is possibly quite decent-minded people, the sort of Craig Murray-type people, saying, well, we've got to do something about that.
Trump's Labour Secretary Alexander Acosta has just quit after the Jeffrey Epstein case row. Acosta's secret plea deal with Epstein came under scrutiny after the billionaire financier was recently charged with sex crimes. This is just a few hours ago on Sky. US Labour Secretary Alexander Acosta has quit. He announced the news at the White House. Trump said Acosta had been great in the role. The only trouble is he helped sort out some sort of weird plea deal whereby Epstein was kept out of jail in a previous case.
Well, I do follow this, but not as closely as some people, others do. Epstein is probably an intelligence agent. Dare I say it, he may be connected to the Israelis. I'm not saying that's for sure, but that's the sort of thing that's possible.
Well, certainly one of our sources over there has been telling us that.
That's what we've been hearing on the grapevine. And, of course, basically what this is about is political blackmail. Come to my island, have sex with underage girls. It's all great.
I will film it.
Nobody, you can all have great fun, but later on, of course, we're going to be saying you are going to war with Iran, aren't you? You don't want your wife to see this.
So how come now? I mean, he's been let off before. Why now? Not now?
Well, it's hard to know why these things come to a head at the time they do.
I mean, what about US-Israeli relationships?
Well, exactly. This may be it, yeah. There's underlying, the purpose of all of this, sex trafficking at the highest level and what you might call VIP pedophilia is essentially political blackmail. It's not just naughty boys doing naughty things that they shouldn't be doing not being punished. The whole purpose of it all is to create, potential for blackmail.
Also, talking of blackmail, well, I don't know anyone's been blackmailing in Turkey, but this is, I mean, it's quite incredibly shocking, really. The Turks are now bringing in a missile system, apparently, specifically, so that they can shoot down American jets if they need to. And this is after the coup attempt a couple of years ago, of course. The S-400 just starting to be deployed now over there. And the Americans are saying, well, if you're going to put the S-400 there, you can't use our £70 million a pop F-35 Joint Strike Fighter.
Well, and quite a lot of the components for the F-35 are actually made in Turkey. So if the Americans are going to do that, they're going to have to find somewhere else to build it. I think what's happening is that...
Is Turkey really still in NATO? If it's
officially, and they certainly haven't said we're going to use the S-400 to shoot down US planes.
What's
happening is that they are gradually moving themselves into what you might call a neutral position between the Russians.
Ooh, well, that's a bit iffy for the Turks. Do you think they can maintain a neutral position?
Well, they beat back the coup attempt, and my best understanding of that is that Erdogan, who is actually... He and Putin were at daggers drawn after the shooting down of the Russian plane inside Syrian airspace, but Putin, grandmaster chess player as he is, told Erdogan what was going to happen, that the Americans were about to try and overthrow him, and basically ensured that, because they were going to try and kill him, they weren't just going to try and drive him from power, he was going to be killed, and he survived as a result of Putin's tip-off. And at that point, Erdogan owes Putin one. And of course, the Russians are quite happy to sell him their missiles. They're selling them to the Saudis, even though they're at war with the Saudis in Syria. And what the Russians are trying to do is say, we're reliable partners. Yeah, whoever you are, whether you're opposed to us, whether you're on our side, whether you're in the middle, when we say we're going to do something, we do it. And these are a defensive system.
Well, they could only be used to shoot down.
Putin
is at least looking to make a buck here, isn't he? I mean, Saudis spend more than almost anybody else.
Oh yeah, and they don't forget the military-industrial complex in Russia works in a bit of a different way. It's basically nationalised.
And you can bet your bottom dollar,
by selling it on, they actually defray some of the costs.
You can bet your bottom dollar that a Russian Sukhoi or a MiG, as it's flying over, if one of these things is fired at it, the pilot's got a little button he can press and it won't work. You're hardly likely to see these S-400s shooting Russian planes.
Well, I think I'm not an expert, but I would think that any missile, once it's fired in a certain direction, is going to hit, you know, it's either going to hit the target or it isn't. Don't forget that the Russians were experts in rocketry rather than anything else. You know, their kit is designed just to, I mean, the stuff they've developed to shoot aircraft carriers and so on isn't electronically sophisticated. It's just very, very fast. Yeah, it just goes so fast towards you that you can't stop it.
Okay, let's have a look at Pakistan now, because this hasn't really been reported as much as I think it should have done. It's these three private TV channels taken off the air by Imran Khan, and also a opposition leader's interview was taken off the air whilst it was actually being broadcast in Pakistan. I mean, it must be a bit weird, mustn't it, when you sort of switch, you're in the middle of watching something and suddenly it just switches off. This TV channel is no longer available. It's actually Radio Liberty. One of their headlines today is, this channel is currently unavailable. Pakistani TV stations taken off the air amid state crackdown. Actually, Pakistani media is some of the best in the world. If you can get it in English language, you probably find out almost everything that's going on around the planet.
Well, I didn't know that this had taken place, Tony, so it's hard to comment, because you don't know what the motivations are or who it is that's been taken down and why. And since I don't know, it's very hard to say anything. I mean, he's obviously got opposition. I mean, politics in Pakistan's a rough old trade. Afzal, who's our local councillor here in Eastern, his family originally from Pakistan, and, you know, they've had various military dictatorships. There's an awful lot of terrorism, guerrilla warfare, whatever you want to call it.
Let's have a look at what media rights watchdogs are saying. They've condemned the suspension of three Pakistani TV news stations for airing an opposition leader's press conferences and brazen censorship, calling the move indicative of disturbing dictatorial tendencies. This is absolutely unacceptable violation of the principles of media pluralism and independence during a revelation that was clearly in the Pakistani public interest. We call on Prime Minister Imran Khan's civilian government to take immediate steps to ensure cable transmissions of the three TV channels are restored.
Well, I mean, my instinct in general is that this is a bad thing, but I don't really know why he's done it. And this kind of banning of things like this doesn't even work.
Okay.
I mean, this is why it's so silly.
The question is,
the people
story?
Are going to say this stuff
what
whether
story,
you ban it or not.
Martin, what story were they in the middle of reporting when
I don't know,
the TV channel closed down?
That's the nub of the matter. What is this all about? And
okay,
I don't know. I have to admit, I don't know.
Well, it reads like something from the Max Headroom series, if you've ever seen that. So it says the news television channels 24, Abtak News and Capital TV were taken off the air. And Nawaz, a daughter of a three-time former Prime Minister, Nawaz Sharif, assailed the government in the briefing, sharing a video she claimed proved evidence the judge who convicted her father on corruption charges a year ago was blackmailed. The judge has since denied the claim. Pakistan's media regulator issued notices to TV news channels for airing press conference live. Over the last year, journalists and rights groups have told Al Jazeera authorities repeatedly disrupted distribution networks for print and television news stories over coverage deemed unfavourable. So, I mean, this is really about corruption trial and someone saying that she's had evidence, the fellow's daughter, that the judge was bribed, but he's saying he wasn't.
Well, I can just say that virtually all Pakistani politicians are corrupt, and I'm afraid Imran Khan is not entirely beyond such things. So the idea that Nawaz Sharif's people are innocent and therefore this is directed at them politically is probably wrong. But nevertheless, you can't repress people's political views in this way successfully in the modern era. It just doesn't work.
In a similar way, we've seen this whole business with Tommy Robinson this week, haven't we?
Yeah.
Him being jailed for reporting what he was saying was a corrupt trial as well. So the relationship between the media and the judiciary, no?
Well, I mean, they're two different cases. I know more about that case. I mean, what happened with him is that he basically, the prosecution ran the risk of not convicting the grooming gang because he was basically sticking his finger in. He's been sent down for contempt of court. And what the judges have said, if we allow people to do what he was doing, the trials will collapse. The defence lawyers were all getting ready to say this isn't a fair trial because we've got Tommy Robinson out there screaming and shouting that they're guilty until proved innocent, and the defence lawyers will be able to get him off. So if you just shut up, we might be able to get him sent down. And they did get him sent down, but the judge in the trial said, we nearly lost this because of you, because you don't listen to when I say you're not to stand outside the court and accuse, you know, because basically filming the people coming in and out and saying they were already guilty, which is basically, you know, contempt of court.
Yes. Well, we try and steer clear of those kinds of legal problems here on this programme. We try and do everything we can legally. But it's not necessarily an easy thing to do these days, because there is a move here in the UK to make much, much less local news, even though, of course, there's a lot of community stations out there. They're not really funded in the way that they could be and should be, like the commercial channels, like Heart and people like that. So there is an enormous change going on, Martin, at the moment, and the House of Commons has been looking at it over the last couple of weeks. One of the MPs who's particularly interested in all of this, and I believe he's a chair of the UK Media Union's parliamentary group, John Grogan, brought up a question at the... I mean, we hear Prime Minister's questions quite often on this programme. One thing we don't very often hear is DCMS questions, the Department for Culture, Media and Sport, and here's what he had to say last week.
Grogan! Given that media giant Global, despite making massive profits, has cut no less than 11 local radio studios in England, isn't there a danger that under these weaker Ofcom regulations, commercial local radio will increasingly lose its localness and broadcasts will increasingly be made from London or several regional centres?
I understand the Honourable Gentleman's concern, but for a start, the localness guidelines are strict, they are tough, and it will require large commercial radio corporations, to have local studios. They will have to provide quite a serious amount of local news content, weather, driving, etc. So I don't share his concern, and it is up to Ofcom to police this, and I think they're doing a good job. And we must remember that for radio, local, commercial and indeed community radio to be sustainable, they did need a lighter touch regulatory regime.
Well, that's an answer there from the Minister. Martin, John Grogan's saying there, he's the Labour MP for Keighley in Yorkshire as well, is that although these local radio licences are being franchised out or auctioned off to anyone who wants to bid for them, what's happening is there's two big companies. There's one's called Global, which is US owned, and one called Bauer, which is a German owned company. They are the ones that put in the high bids. And actually, what they're doing is they're bidding for lots of contracts together, and they're basically making regional and national stations where there should be local ones, and they're closing the local newsrooms.
Well, that's right. This is all about regulation, isn't it? There's only a certain amount of bandwidth.
Well, Ofcom changed the rules last year.
Well, exactly. There's only a certain amount of bandwidth, and pirate radio is pirate radio because basically they're taking other people's bandwidth. And ultimately, if there's going to be a certain amount of bandwidth, you've got to have some rules about who's allowed and who's not allowed to use it.
Well,
if you design it to allow, you could just say that if you're going to be a local community, a local station, you can only have one local station. Yeah, whoever bids for it has just got to take that one local franchise.
What we've got is hundreds of local licences across the country all
going to big ones
by these two massive companies.
Well,
one
regulation you could just put in if you wanted to keep it local. You say each commercial station has to be just one local area, and that's it. You can't have any more than one.
What a good idea, but they don't do that. Ofcom are doing completely the opposite. And here is also on a similar topic is Kevin Brennan. He's the Shadow Arts and Culture Minister and MP for Cardiff West. list.
On the issue of commercial radio, her honourable friend earlier on said we need more local radio. The result of this deregulation is there are job cuts and fewer stations in what is a profitable commercial sector. Isn't it time that this decision is reviewed to see the impact it's having on localness, to make sure that local radio doesn't just become national commercial radio?
The localness guidelines only came in October last year, so I think it would be premature to announce a review of their impact just as yet. And I would like to reassure the honourable gentleman that the radio, the new guidelines were welcomed by commercial radio, by the community radio stations as well.
No, they were.
Ofcom have had, I think it's about 700 expressions of interest in these small-scale DAB multiplexes, which we introduced legislation to enable last month, and we hope to be able to complete that legislation by the end of the year so that Ofcom will be able to start issuing licences to hundreds of community radio stations up and down the country. And I think we will see a great growth in this fantastic sector.
Margot James is the minister, but you know, I don't think community radio stations across the country want to have commercial local radio to compete with, that is run nationally. With I mean, one of the things they've been doing, for example, with these big people like Heart, etc., is they have to produce some local content. So there are rules about how many local stories they can produce. So they have to do, for example, in the west of England, they'll have to do one Exeter story, one Plymouth story, one Bristol story, and one Gloucester story every day.
Well, you know more about this kind of structure of local radio than I do.
What it means is that studios are closing and journalists are being sacked, basically, and it's all being concentrated.
I mean, ultimately, what's going on here is the corporate takeover of the means of communication. And if you want to have basically, the argument that everything should just be run by the private sector is wrong. It's all regulated. Ultimately, you could just say, we're going to give everybody a fair crack of the whip here, and we're not going to allow the big boys to just run the whole thing.
Well, I think I agree. And I had a chat to John Grogan, the Keighley MP, about this last week.
My name's John Grogan. I'm a Member of Parliament for Keighley in Yorkshire, and we're having a meeting here with the unions, the NUJ and Equity and other, the Federation of Entertainment Unions, and we're having a meeting about local commercial radio and the threat to local stations.
These licences have been basically expanding, so companies have been buying neighbouring licences and treating them all as one. Yeah. There's also been something called news hubbing, where they bring newsrooms all together in a distant remote city. Yeah. Of course, this isn't really local radio anymore, and yet those licences are still being farmed out as local radio licences.
Yeah. So the regulator is called Ofcom, and I think they've been pretty weak because they've listened to the two big boys who really dominate this industry now, called Global, which is American, and Bauer, which is German, and they own well over half the radio stations now, the local ones, between them. So what Ofcom have agreed is that they can cut the number of hours that they have to produce local programmes to 3 hours a day for all these local radio stations. And then they've said that local, in my case, means the whole of Yorkshire, or in Wales's case, the whole of Wales. So if you've got a local radio station on the Yorkshire coast, it's quite all right for all of their output, their local 3 hours, to come from Leeds.
Why have Ofcom done this? It sounds to me as if they've just caved into the industry.
Caved into commercial.
Why?
Demands.
Why?
Well, I think
they're supposed to be the regulators. You can't just do what the industry wants, can you?
No, well, they shouldn't. And I think the government have encouraged them to go down this route. I mean, local radio has never been a big money owner, but it's washed its face. And I still think it can wash its face. You know, local radio stations can have more digital output than they had in the past. These regulations have changed. About Global, who own a lot of radio stations, they've cut over a dozen centres of local radio altogether. We're trying to influence Bauer, who are the Germans, and they've got to make their decision. For example, in Yorkshire, they own out 16 out of the 20 stations. What are they going to do? Are they going to take a different view, perhaps respect localness a little bit more than their American cousins did? And we've got to try and make sure that if there's a change of government at any stage, these regulations are looked at.
There's a bit of a sinister Orwellian side to this. Isn't it really about central control of information?
I think there's something wonderful about local news, isn't there? Because if you've got local news...
Well, you have also you have different points of view coming from a local area than the establishment view.
You do, and you can get a campaign going, you know, against a closure or in favour of building something. You know, as a local politician, local radio station, just like the local newspaper, if that's gone, well, then you don't really have a space where people can get together and campaign and organise and advertise the fact that they're doing that. So there is something very democratic about good independent local news sources, whether that's in print, whether that's online, or whether that's the radio station. So our democracy definitely loses something if we lose local radio, and we should do everything we can to preserve it. And also on digital platforms as well, we need to look at how we can make sure that multiplexes, digital multiplexes, when they're rolled out locally, are not completely dominated.
What is a digital multiplex?
Well, as far as I understand it, it is broadcasting, instead of FM frequencies, it's broadcasting through digital means. And the digital radio channels, yeah. But a lot of the local multiplexes are owned by the same people, Global and Bauer, who own their radio stations.
Well, that sounds like a very good bit of vertical integration by them.
It does.
But
it does, yeah.
Who's going to win, the shareholders of these big companies or the local radio listeners?
Yeah, certainly not the listeners, and I'd call them citizens as well, you know. The shareholders are going to win because they then virtually change the local radio stations into national radio stations, and they've got more outlets. That's their business model, with a little bit of local content. So you have one story a day about Scarborough if you're running the coastal radio station, and that's all you've got to do. And you can produce that from Leeds.
Any listeners that care about local radio, what can they do?
Well, talk about it, raise it, write to your MP, write to your local newspaper, show you care, really, and because if we don't care, it'll be gone.
That's John Grogan, Martin, and he's talking there about something which hasn't really been reported very much, which is that these big companies, not only do they actually own the, employ the journalists, they own the studios and they own the transmitters, but they also own these digital multiplexes which are transmitting everybody's signals. So there is really, I call it their vertical integration, but they own the whole lot.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's definitely, monopolisation going on in this sector, and it's very important all over the world. I mean, I thought when he said global, he was talking about Globo TV in Brazil, which have been big supporters of Bolsonaro. And, of course,
do things like Classic FM and various other things, but okay. What they're doing is they've made such a lot of money nationally that they're starting to buy up all these local stations. But for example, here in Bristol, what frustrates me is that we've got communities from all over the world here, and we've every ability to do international program from Bristol, but it just simply doesn't happen. What happens is all of the international and all the national news comes from London.
Well, I think what we've done on this program over 10 years, Tony, is to show that local and international and national news can be integrated and nested together in the modern digital era. It doesn't just have to be about Cats Up Tree in Keighley. It can also be about, you know, the local, the international stuff, but from a local perspective. And of course, when you were just on FM, you could only broadcast locally. But of course, all local radio can now be listened to all over the world. I was talking to somebody in the pub over the road some years ago. I was talking about what we were doing. He said, well, I listen to this surfing station in Australia because I'm a surfer, and it's a local station in Australia that covers surfing. But it's got an international following because, you know, even though it's only broadcast locally in one area of Australia.
It's all just about money, though, isn't it? I mean, these stations like Heart just make more money as a national station because they're not employing hardly anybody anymore.
Well, that's right. So you just end up with a uniform, bland, universal product. There's beef burgers, which can be of all varieties, and there's McDonald's.
staying in the UK, because we've kind of gone from censorship of one sort over in Pakistan to censorship of another sort here in the UK. One of the things that came up at Prime Minister's questions this week, we didn't have a chance for in the first hour, but it's fascinating anyway, is to do with Serco. This is the company, Martin, the private company that's still running some private prisons.
Are we going to hear some more about them?
We can do. What do you think just generally about prison privatisation? This is following the US model.
Wrong in principle. Taking away somebody's liberty because they have broken the law is a very, very serious thing. And you shouldn't have a situation where people are making any kind of profit about it at all. Because it also encourages the prisoners to believe that they're being hard done by. Yeah, and if you're going to be serious about punishing them, it's got to be seen to be the whole of society punishing them because they've done the wrong thing, not somebody trying to make money out of them.
In 2013, evidence came to light suggesting Serco may have been fraudulently charging the government on its offender tagging contract, including for monitoring people who were dead. Serco had to pay back tens of millions to the government and lost the tagging contract. Now, a subsequent serious fraud office investigation has seen Serco fined £90 million for fraud and false accounting linked to those prisoner tagging contracts. Mr Speaker, does the Minister agree that this is just the latest scandal to hit our justice system involving the private sector in recent months? We've seen the private probation contracts terminated early. We've seen HMP Birmingham Private Prison return to the public sector and new research showing disproportionate violence in private prisons. We've seen the collapse of Carillion, meaning prison maintenance works were brought back in-house. Each time we're told it's an isolated case. So will the Minister finally admit that in reality it is a systematic failure? Mr Speaker, regarding Serco, Serco has £3.5 billion of current contracts with the Ministry of Justice. So can the Minister commit today, given the serious fraud office findings, that there will now be a special audit of all existing Serco Justice contracts? Those Serco contracts include running prisons. The government's currently receiving bids for a new generation of private prisons. Can the Minister assure me today that Serco will not be allowed to run these new private prisons? And finally, Mr Speaker, we have a current Justice Minister, not here today, who once worked for Serco as its chief spin doctor. So can the Minister guarantee that that Justice Minister has had no involvement in overseeing any current Serco contracts and will have no role in handing over any future lucrative contracts to his former employer?
Minister! Thank you very much indeed. The Honourable Gentleman behaves as though this is somehow a new piece of information that has come to light. If anything, this is a very old piece of news, dating back to 2013-14, which has a very long tail. The SFO conducted a very complex investigation into the fraudulent aspects of this behaviour. But in 2013-14, there was a vigorous effort on the part of the government to investigate what Serco were doing and how they were managing these contracts that led to significant cultural change. I'm afraid all we've heard today is a predictable ideological tirade of hostility towards the private sector's role that they play within our justice system. That simply does not stand up to scrutiny. He raises the fact of Carillion once again. Carillion, of course, was a very different affair. It cannot be compared at all with what's going on with Serco. He makes a point about the member for Charnwood. The member for Charnwood, the minister, has no Serco contracts within his ministerial responsibility. That is a complete red herring. And the ministry has already begun an audit into its contract for prisoner escort and custody services that Serco currently hold. We have taken action back in 2013-14. This has transformed not just how the Ministry of Justice conducts its private sector contracts, but government as a whole. And we are confident that the work we have ongoing will make sure that we continue to deliver high quality services at the best value for the taxpayer. Yeah.
Well, that apparently wasn't David Gawke, the Justice Secretary. I'm not quite sure who it was, Martin, but there's a pretty good exposition there of why you shouldn't have a Serco involved, and then what we heard from the Minister was why we should.
Well, he just asserted that the private sector was doing a good job and people who said otherwise were nincompoops, which is just missing the point. The question is, should the private sector be involved in any public? There's a big problem when the private sector carries out governmental functions, because the private sector's got a different set of priorities than government has. That's why there used to be a fairly clear separation between the two things.
But, I mean, since then, we've had all these things called partnerships, weren't they, where they're part funded by private industry and part funded by government. Well, for example, the people putting 5G and doing a lot of research into it here in Bristol, they are partnerships.
Well,
they consider themselves public sector, even though they're largely privately funded.
In the 1940s, people would have laughed about that. The idea that the government should be run by the private sector. The private sector has got its own role to fulfil. It's about making profits for shareholders, and the government is there to defend the public interest. The idea that it's why don't we all just get together is actually very, very dangerous, because that actually undermines the public service function of government. The government is not there, and of course they say, well, there's expertise in the private sector, but it's the wrong kind of expertise. Running a hospital is not the same as selling cornflakes. They're not the same thing at all. And in actual fact, central planning of core functions without internal markets is by far the most efficient way to run it.
Love Bristol.
Love
BCFM 93.2.
And now to Alex Craner. Martin, this is really, I suppose, one of your pet subjects, which is economic collapses. What happened in Russia in 1990?
Well, Jeffrey Sachs and various other people came over there and said, what you need to do is have a shock therapy. It worked in Britain. It worked in Poland, which obviously I've been working in Poland by that, so it's going to work for you. So you've got all this people stuck in the mud bureaucracy. You've just got to get rid of it all. Just let prices rip, and then the free market will sort it all out. And, of course, what happened was the economy collapsed, because that was a silly way to approach reforming
and there was
a centralised economy.
And there was no money, and this is how Alex Craner explains what life was like in Russia with no money.
We know that the Russian economy, after these reforms got enacted, was functioning at something like 16% of the money mass that the economy of its size required. So what happened is that nobody had any money. Companies didn't have money to pay their employees or to pay their bills or to acquire the goods to run their business. People were not receiving salary, police, military, nobody was getting any money. People were being paid in kind. So if you worked in a clothes store, in a clothes factory, they would just give you, you know, jackets and pants and socks. And if you worked in a food store, a food company, they would give you pasta and cans of meat.
Well, so this is a kind of barter system developing.
Yeah, because there was no money to pay people. There's just like simply no cash. And so what people had to do after work, they had to take this to pawn it off in the street and to exchange it for things that they needed. Okay? And so in this environment, people were very, very busy just making sure that they survive, and that wasn't easy. And then, so in this environment, the privatization of Russia's state companies took place. Nobody had any money to buy these shares. And when the so-called voucher privatization took place, and these 10,000 ruble vouchers were distributed to all the Russian people, they had no idea what to do with them, but they knew that they needed food. And so what happened is that all these voucher agents went around Russia and collected vouchers from the people for sausages, for bottles of vodka, for essentially nothing. And then they turned around and they acquired the stock shares of these of the best of the best of Russia's economy for essentially nothing.
That's Alex Craner. We'll be hearing more from him next week, but that's all for this week. Time to sign off for the US-owned Comcast News at 8. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, and Tar from the Brexit Party, and also Sally Bear from the 5G campaign. You'll find us online at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Do please join us 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Sky News Centre.